Okay, hi, can you tell me your name and can you spell it, please?
Sally Barker, SallyBarker.
Great, and your date of birth?
5/12/62.
And can you tell me where you lived in Leytonstone?
Yeah, I lived on Philibrook Road, which was knocked down for the M11.
What was the number?
I think it was 121.
Right.
Yeah.
And when did you move into the area?
Moved in about 2 years after leaving college, so that would be 89, 90.
Uh-huh. And who was your landlord at that time?
Acme.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you remember how much rent you were paying?
We all paid about £9 each. There were four of us. No, there were five of us, so yeah, about less than £50 for the house. A week? Yeah.
And there were who else were you sharing the house with at the time?
Paul Noble, who was my partner at the time. John Pettinuzzo, Doug Moore, and Tina... Oh, gosh, I can't remember Tina's surname. Doug's partner, who we were actually at college with.
Right.
So I was at college with Doug and Tina. That's strange, I can't remember her name. Doug and Tina were in my year, Paul was in the year below me, and John Pettinuzzo was our technician.
And where had you been? You say you went to college.
That was in Hull, on BA, so that was a couple of years previous, yeah.
And you were studying what in Hull?
Fine art, painting.
And then how did it sort of come about that you... So you left for a couple of years and...
I left Hull in 86 to do my MA in Manchester. And then when I finished my MA, Paul was finishing his BA in Hull. So we decided to move down to London. So we moved down. We squatted for a couple of years around Bow.
Mm-hmm.
Around Stepney. And then the Acme opportunity came up because John got the tenancy on the house.
Right.
So he asked us to come and share with him because it was quite a big house. So we shared and we asked Doug and Tina, who were a couple, to share as well.
And was that him subletting to you?
Subletting to us, yeah.
And mm-hmm. So Acme didn't really know?
Oh, no, Acme knew, yeah. It was all... Acme... I don't think Acme minded as long as you paid the rent.
Right.
So, yeah.
And squatting in Bow for a couple of years prior to...
Yeah, in Stepney, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, squatted, came down and got a squat in a council flat that had been boarded up for a while. We sort of tapped into the squatters' network, which was going at the time, in Stepney, and everybody sort of helps each other to find properties and break in and just, yeah, we were quite naive about things like that, so we needed the help. And so we lived in that council flat for about a year, and then we got prefab.
All right.
Around the corner from there, which was fantastic. So we lived in squatted the prefab for a little while. And then I had a short time in a co-op house,
mm-hmm.
in Bow for a little while. And then we got the house in Leytonstone with John, yeah. And that was fantastic. It was wonderful. Just a really lovely house, lovely area, big community of artists. Just really nice.
Mm.
Big garden.
And So John had already applied to Acme for the housing. He'd been through that process rather than yourselves.
Yeah, yeah. I really can't remember, to be honest. I can't remember the ins and outs. Maybe we did get on the tenancy with Acme. It was certainly all above board. I remember, you know, I knew Roger Kite, who was one of the big people in Acme, and we would see people, so it was all kind of above board.
Yeah,
that we were all there, that there were five of us in the house instead of just one, because we're literally quite huge houses, so there's no way they would have expected.
Maybe
we even actually, it's possible that we took the ground floor tenancy. I really don't remember exactly how it worked.
And had John already moved in when you came along? Was that?
Yeah, I think John had only been there for a short while. Yeah. You know, maybe a couple of months, and perhaps was seeing how it went.
Yeah.
Before he asked someone else to join him.
Yeah. And can you sort of describe the house when you arrived? What it was like? What it looked like? What it felt like? What it was? The structure of it.
Well, it was. It was an Edwardian terrace house, so quite big. It had that kind of big square sort of front, as opposed to Victorians, which have quite a lot of ornate kind of decorative elements on the outside. This was quite square, so big square bow windows, top and bottom. Nice big stone stairs to go up to the front door, big heavy door. You know, it felt kind of like a proper house.
Mm.
For the first time, probably. It had a nice feel to it. It had a really nice feel to it. It was cold, obviously, because, you know, it hadn't been lived in for a while. It was the sort of house that needed heating a lot, you know. And a really nice big garden at the back.
Mm.
So, yeah. And I had a studio there, and John had a studio there, and we sort of divided it up, really.
So what was downstairs like?
Well, downstairs was Doug and Tina had a big front bedroom, and they had a very big room at the back, which was their living room, and I don't know how this happened, really, but maybe because I took the front room as my studio, but we didn't seem to have a living room, which seems a bit strange. John was not bothered at all. John just worked away. He was quite quite like a hermit, really.
Mm-hmm.
There was a certain amount of communal living, and the rest was quite separate.
Right.
Actually, we did have a living room. Sorry, we did have a living room. We had the back room as our living room. So yeah, we did. That was quite cosy. Yeah. Yeah. So there was 1, 2, 4 rooms upstairs, which were kind of Paul and I and John, and then downstairs there was 2 rooms for Doug and Tina, and then there was a shared kitchen and dining room downstairs, and a shared bathroom and toilet.
That's huge.
Yeah, it was one of those big terrace houses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was live-work? Live-studio space?
All Acme were, really. They were all... People used the houses as their studios.
Yeah. So how did that fit in with your sort of living room, sleeping arrangements? Because... You talked about the people downstairs having a front room as a bedroom and a back room as a living room.
Well, it worked fine. So there's only me and John who were working there, who were using their using it as studios.
Right.
Doug and Tina didn't. So it worked fine. Yeah.
So you had one room. You had one room as a studio.
I had the studio, yeah, the biggest room at the front, which was my studio. John gave it up. I think John took a rented studio after a while.
Right.
And offered it to me.
Right.
So he had lots of stuff in his kind of bedroom. It was the way that he chose to live. He always lived like that, John, until he got married later on. He always lived kind of everything in one room, you know, very, yeah, very, very simple way of living.
Yeah.
That was his choice.
Right. And that was upstairs in the house.
Yeah. Mm. It was working. It was like walking into a storage space going into John's room. Because it was literally floor to ceiling with art materials and art stuff, you know, canvases. And,
yeah.
Because he was predominantly a painter at the time, although he branched into sculpture like me. So he just used to collect stuff. So walking into his room was quite interesting.
And what was he collecting?
Just stuff to make things out of.
Right. But from the area?
Yeah. He always made work from the stuff that was around him. When he was in Hull, he made work from the mud in the river.
Mm.
He made paintings using the mud from the river. So, and then gradually when we were in London, he did this gradually, but he started to make sculpture from wood that he'd find lying around in skips.
Yeah.
Skip hunter.
Right. It's interesting.
Fantastic work, but definitely that kind of, reusing.
Yeah.
Local found materials.
Yeah.
Very interesting work.
And was there actually heating in the building at all? Or?
There was central heating, yeah, but it quite often didn't work. So it was quite cold. We also had fires. We had gas fires. So that was the main source of heating.
Right. Yeah. You didn't have because most of this house have open fires, don't they?
They do, but no, we didn't. Oh, tell a lie, we did. We had one in the dining room. Yeah.
That you utilised?
We did occasionally use it, yeah. Yeah, that was good. Yeah.
And during your period of time there, did you make any sort of alterations?
To the building?
To the building, yeah.
I remember thinking at the time we felt like we couldn't do very much to it because we only ever had a year lease at a time.
Yeah.
So it did prevent you from investing, yeah. Didn't really put any money into it, no.
But thinking also about the work that maybe people were making and the structure of the building and the people that lived there, and did you make any sort of changes to accommodate your own necessities in that way?
I don't really know what you mean.
Well, really just, there's sort of four or five of you living there.
Mm.
Couple of you are using as your studio spaces, some of that's upstairs, if you're making large work, how did you get it downstairs? If that wasn't necessary, were there any sort of physical changes you made just to accommodate your personal needs in that way?
No, I don't think we did. No, just wherever you are, I've realised this, wherever you are, you make work according to the limitations that you've got, right? So yeah, of course, we could have... I'm sure we talked about, if we needed to, we could take out the windows to get big work out of the front window. But we never had to do that. So you just go with the size that you can cope with, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just sort of stepping back a little bit, was there anything that actually really attracted you to Leytonstone, to the Acme housing, other than having a friend here that moved in? And
it was cheap and it was a step up from squatting, yeah. So that was it, really. I was a bit scared about moving up there, not scared, but I was a bit apprehensive that it felt like such a long way out,
right,
at the time, living in Stepney.
From?
And Bow.
A long way out,
from there or from the West End, really.
Yeah.
When you're in Stepney, and I moved back to Stepney after quite a few years of being in Leytonstone, you're very close. You can cycle into the West End or, anywhere in the city in half an hour at the most. So moving up to Leytonstone felt like you were almost in Essex, it's that sort of mentality, that mindset. And once you've lived here for a while, obviously you get used to that and you don't feel so kind of isolated. But that was, I was apprehensive about that.
Yeah.
We all were.
Right. That's interesting. And that move down to London as well, was that sort of an easy move to make?
Yeah, it was quite easy. I was slightly dubious about that, really. Paul wanted to move down here, and I was quite ambivalent about it, really. I wanted to stay up north. Part of me wanted to stay up north, and part of me wanted to come and explore, you know, London. Yeah. So I was. I didn't jump in with both feet like Paul did.
Right.
So we did know a few people down here, so that was good.
And was it what was your ambivalence about? Was it?
I suppose I felt like my identity was with the north.
Right.
It's quite sort of simple, really. I felt like my roots are up there, and I just felt a stronger sense of place, and that I could be an artist up there without having to be in London. Yeah. I just felt like London was going to be really difficult, really hard. You know, I knew that really the only option was squatting, and I was very unsure about that.
Mm.
Always, you know, even when I was doing it, I was very unsure about it. So.
And you sort of touched on it a little bit with the idea of not changing your housing around. I was just thinking about the fact that you knew you were coming in on short-term lease, didn't you? Rent, rather.
Yeah.
Do you think that at all changed the way you thought about your work or what you did? Do you think that maybe didn't change it, but it was always there at the back of your mind? Or
no, it was only there in terms of the house, in terms of living. It wasn't there in terms of my work.
Yeah.
So I don't think it affected my work. Well, I don't know. As we're talking, I might rethink that one, actually. But I don't remember making... I started to make work about the fact that we were losing the house, but it wasn't a kind of... Oh, gosh, I'm... No, I can't really say that, can I?
Yes, you can.
No, because I don't think that's true. I think maybe the insecurity was always there when I was making that work. Maybe it's all wrapped up. I don't know.
Right.
Maybe it's all wrapped up together that, you know, I made work that was about the road being built, and I suppose that's the insecurity. But at the same time, I think this is what I'm getting at. At the same time, I felt like it was quite a strong time to be making work. The ideas were strong.
Right.
And that's, you know, even though you're making work about something that's very kind of vulnerable and you're quite insecure, to make work that you feel very strongly about is a very secure kind of feeling.
Mm.
So there's a bit of a, whatever that word is, there's a kind of dichotomy or something involved there. Yeah. But maybe, I don't know, maybe we can unravel that as we're talking.
Yeah, anytime. You can just flow into it. So what sort of work were you making prior to moving into the area? Maybe from, well, Manchester, you said you were doing an MA at Manchester and then you moved down and...
Yeah. I was making abstract paintings, quite large and... very much to do with a kind of emotional, quite emotive kind of forms. So they were all to do with, well, for example, in Manchester, it was all to do with the landscape and kind of heavy weather and building up this sort of sense of foreboding, kind of strong, kind of quite poetic kind of paintings that were black, grey, white, pale sort of colours in contrast, very very sort of heavy, all to do with kind of heavy. I was quite unhappy in Manchester. I was quite unhappy. I was quite sad, I should say. I was quite disappointed with the way things had worked out in Manchester, with having doing an MA, thinking when I went on the MA that I was a bit of a high flyer just because I got on the MA, which is so not true. When you look back on it, even after a few months, you realise that there's a bit of a slipstream going from Hull into Manchester. It's not that difficult to get in, especially if you do a certain kind of painting. So I tried to break out of I felt like I was pigeonholed and I tried to break out of it.
Right.
In fact, I did very successfully, but I was kind of, I feel like I was kind of castigated for that.
Yeah.
Like I was not towing the line. And by doing that, I was, a lot of us were ignored, actually. The guys were in the pub most of the time, the tutors. So I was very disappointed with the whole scene doing my MA. Mm. And I think it did knock me. I think I came down to London with that feeling that I'd been knocked.
Right.
I kind of slightly knocked off my perch. Not a bad thing, really. I'd probably having a bit of a wobble, really. And I think moving into that house, coming back to the house on Philibrook, was just really great, because it was really a good community, and people were around, you know, made friends very quickly up in Leytonstone. There was a lot of artists in Acme houses. So it was good. It was a good thing to do, definitely. I think I feel like I kind of put down some roots.
Right.
Which is what I needed to do.
Yeah.
Which is not so easy when you're squatting. I mean, I know, bizarrely, that, you know, the lease was only a year and there was never much more of a promise than maybe a couple of years. I don't know. But it still felt like you could be quite firm there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you came down to Stepney. I think I said that. Stepney. And you were still making work, and you were with Paul, and you were both in
You're talking about when we moved down to London from Manchester.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what sort of work did you make at that point?
Well, it was a continuation of what I'd been doing in Manchester.
Right.
I didn't abruptly stop doing it, so I was quite happy with that, actually. I was quite happy with that work, even though I had no backing from the tutors in Manchester. I was quite sure about what I was doing, and my work's always changing, so it did start to change. I started to introduce a more of a sculptural element into it, and particularly when I had a studio for a little while in Bow, and then I had the studio in Philibrook when we moved up there. Maybe that was after a little while. I think John had the studio in Philibrook for a while, and then I took it over. So I did start to stick things on the canvases more. That was a kind of gradual process. Started to stick things on. So the 2D going into 3D was started to happen. Probably a year after I'd moved down. Yeah, something like that.
And the studio you talk about, you had the studio after John, that's the one outside of the house? Where you took the front room?
Yeah. Yeah. I think he moved to Carpenter's. I think he got a studio at Carpenter's Road and decided he didn't want to work at home anymore.
Mm.
And I really quite fancied trying that.
Yeah.
It was a good space as well. And obviously cheaper.
Mm.
So that was good. That was good.
Mm. And you were making things 3D. What sort of
started to introduce 3D elements onto the surface.
Yeah.
Which was mainly sort of natural elements like twigs and leaves. So I went through a kind of period of picking up stuff from the forest at the top of the road and bringing them down and using them. So either painting them or sticking them on a kind of flat, you know, flat way of using 3D stuff, or a low relief.
Yeah.
And ordering them. So sort of, you know, making little patterns out of them, really, I suppose. But, And painting things as well, so using the two different kinds of elements in the same painting.
Were they quite large pieces, or what sort of size?
They varied, actually. I think when I was in, when I had the studio in Philibrook, there were about 4 foot by 2 or 3 foot, that kind of size. Some were bigger and some were smaller. I was trying to find some images. So yeah, sort of, what is that, medium scale paintings, yeah. But the room could hold it, you know, the room was quite big, really. It's very lucky, I think.
Can you find anything?
No, unfortunately, I couldn't find a whole block of them. But interestingly, I did seem to kind of go back to it, because the work that I'm looking at here is what, certainly when we'd lost the house and I was back down in the studios in Stepney.
Right.
Pixley Street Studios. And I started to paint flowers with sort of little toys hanging around them. And that was a very similar kind of thing going on to the stuff that I was making in Leytonstone.
Right.
Which was painting the natural twigs and leaves and things and trees and sticking, you know, real things on top. So I sort of, you know, yeah, came back to it, I think. Yeah.
And were these sort of materials that we're using were sort of reflective, I suppose, of the area?
Yeah, yeah. I think it was all there that I started to get involved in the campaign, in the road campaign, and so it was very kind of prominent, this whole idea that they were really knocking down a whole area to create this road. It was very I was aware that I wanted to use it in some way in my work, so just used to go for a walk every morning. Before I started work in the studio, and picking up bits and pieces, kind of like, almost like a kind of reverence, you know, a kind of, these were kind of little symbols of what was going to be lost. I think that was the idea. So I would take them back and use them. And I think, you know, the act of painting something so kind of insignificant as a bit of twig that was lying on the on the ground is quite seemed quite important, really.
Yeah.
They were quite humble little things that I brought back. There was nothing special or outstanding about them. Yeah.
So, you know, you're looking at, just thinking about, you talking about your work, there's sort of reflection of public and private almost, isn't there? There's something you're doing which is quite private, but you're bringing that sort of public sphere in, or maybe...
I think when you make any painting, you're making something public. You're making your ideas public. What were you thinking about more than that? What do you mean?
I just... Well, maybe we should come back to that a bit later. So you were just... But you were talking a bit about the campaign, so maybe we should just, you know, talk a bit about...
Yeah.
About the campaign and how your work... Did your work sort of... You're talking about your work changing as you became... Sort of knew a bit more about what was going on.
It's a bit hard to remember, really, what... I can only imagine that, you know, started to be involved in this political kind of arena, thinking in that kind of way, and the ideas were creeping into my work, which which always happens, really. So I don't think there was any... I don't feel like there was any abrupt change. I wasn't aware of, oh, gosh, I must make work about this. And so then I changed the whole style of the way that I was working. It did just seemed a natural kind of progression, really. And my work's always been small politics, being quite important, really. So, actually, I do remember in Manchester that, and in fact in Hull as well, actually, that the whole idea that you make abstract paintings, that people would never want to talk about the subject matter.
Right.
And it used to really, really annoy me. It was a big thing that I was always trying to talk about my ideas behind the work.
Yeah.
And they'd just kind of like, you know, hand would go up like, no, don't want to know about that. That's not important. And I could never understand that. I mean, my work is not overly political at all. And it's not, and you certainly can't see, it's straight, you know, it's not straightforward. It doesn't slap you in the face, but the ideas are very important,
yeah,
as they are with most artists. And so, yeah, it was good to be able to just, you know, make work in the studio. And,
yeah.
And in that sense that you're talking about the public and the private, being in a college is so public. Every single thing that you do is so public and so talked about, or it would be if the tutors went in the pub all day long in Manchester. So, yeah. Now I've lost my thread, but the ideas were certainly there and wanting to be talked about. And, you know, I felt quite proud in a way that I was making work about things that we would, the rest of my life, you know, it was all tied up, it was all wrapped up.
Yeah.
That was good, yeah. Rather than it being separate and, you know, you jump into the studio and you put a different hat on. It wasn't like that at all, you know. It was all very kind of more inspiring than that. It was all much more integrated, the whole life thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Did your work change between that point you were saying when it started to become sort of more sort of 3D, three-dimensional in that sense? Did it change again? Did it change in any way after that?
No. Yes, my work is always changing, but there was no big leaps.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be huge leaps. I just kind of incrementally change, I suppose.
But you were also saying about a bit about the campaign, and that was partly feeding into your work too. I was just wondering, do you know when you first sort of knew about the campaign?
No, I can't remember. No, I have no date, and I don't remember any kind of blinding, you know, road to Damascus or anything. It will have been, we moved in and we'll have realised why the house was in this blighted area.
Yeah.
And then it'll have been a slow kind of dawning. and then obviously just knowing, you know, getting to know everybody in the area who were in the same position.
Yeah.
Some people were involved in the campaign, some weren't. So no, I don't remember anything specific that made me, you know, suddenly realise. Mm.
But it was sort of early on, later on that you...
I really don't remember. It would have been earlier on though, because I was making work about the campaign, you know, all the way through when I had the studio there. And I think I had that studio quite quickly after moving in, because I think John realised that he didn't want the studio there. So, yeah. Sorry, I'm not very good on years, dates.
No, it's not a problem at all. What do you really remember about the protest?
Really, really interesting, funny little demonstrations, that we would cobble together. You know, we had some seasoned campaigners who had fought on other road campaigns and I don't know if there were any road campaigns, but anyway, they had, you know, they'd experienced a lot, older people who had experienced quite a lot. And we would throw together some peaceful protests. And also, the thing I most clearly remember is the public inquiry in Stratford, which I went to a lot because it was just so weird and such an eye opener how things were being done, you know, and sort of how things were being railroaded, really.
That's interesting. Do you want to? It'd be interesting to hear more about that.
Yeah. Well, quite a few of us used to go down as much as possible, you know, when we weren't working. You would make a choice, obviously, of not being in the studio to go down there. So that was quite interesting. But we would, you know, it would be every day for 2 or 3 weeks, you would sit in the town hall and listen to all the debates around whether the road should or shouldn't be built.
Yeah.
Some of which went back, you know, decades, really. And listen to people discussing it and arguing points. And it was just... it was just a real eye-opener. It was very... Some of it was quite heartbreaking because there would be... discussing things and you just knew that it was all being pushed ahead, you know, and there was really the idea that it was a public inquiry was, I don't think a lot of us genuinely understood the process that, you know, if you wanted to speak, you would have to go through various different channels to be heard, to have a voice. So we'd, you know, occasionally just stand up and start ranting. Politely, sometimes, and be asked to sit down and then be asked to leave, you know. So we would, sometimes we just couldn't help ourselves. We'd just be that kind of audience that you could just hear in the background always shouting and couldn't believe it. I remember the phrases like, you know, we just can't believe it. And, you know, weasel words. People would just stand up and go, weasel words. Because they're just, you know, talking about people's houses and lives and just pushing it through. And of course, you know, the Department of Transport would have huge legal backup. And we're going to be clearly going to win it because they had all the, you know, they had everything behind them, really. Yeah. So we, you know, good friendships were made then. It was very funny. It was very funny and very kind of emotional time, I think. That was what I remember most about it. You know, you could quite easily go in there and just start crying. Because it was so... You just felt like you had no chance, you know, no chance at all of being heard or winning or anything. And I guess, you know, I was quite naive when I started to be involved. So there was a bit of a kind of dawning of my, you know, becoming a bit more clued up, less naive. And that's always quite sad. And you lose your optimism and... Yeah. But it was good, and it was quite good fun, actually. The Rumpel of the Bailey sort of thing, you know.
So do you remember any of the things that were said there? Do you remember any of the... who spoke and that sort of thing?
There was a major who was the supposedly the chair, but he was like a judge. You know, he was like a judge, and he would when he arrived, you know, we'd all have to stand up and a very sort of dominant kind of figure. And we used to call him the Galloping Major. I don't know where the Galloping Major comes from, actually, but there's a song, isn't there? So we used to sing that when he walked in. And then he had some... And then the Department of Transport had... It seemed like they were all in league, actually. Yeah. It seemed like he was actually... Because he'd really favour the Department of Transport's legal team.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'd be various other people speaking. So it was, yeah. I remember an incident when... I think it was Christmas time. It was very near Christmas time. Actually, I don't remember how long the whole inquiry lasted for, but it was near Christmas time and we decided to dress up we put pantomime masks on.
Right.
Those cardboard masks that you buy that have got like lords and ladies on them.
Yeah.
And top hats. And we all, I think when he walks in and he sits down, we sort of clocked what he did, the Galloping Major. And so he'd walk in the morning and everybody would have to stand up. Then he'd sit down and everybody had to sit down. And then he'd start shuffling his papers. So his head was down for a good, you know how they do it, the shuffle papers, importantly. And so whilst he did that, we all ducked down and we put our masks. So when he lifted his head, we all had these bizarre, weird, but kind of straight, you know, because they were all like lords and ladies. So there was that was quite good. They weren't like animals or, you know, elephants or anything. It was good. His face was very good when he looked up. I think he was laughing, actually. I think he couldn't resist it. So we did have some good fun. Yeah.
And can you remember anything that was sort of said in that whole process at all, you know, through that inquiry? Did any of the artists speak or any of the other protesters?
John Ellis was very, very good. John Ellis is a good friend. He's a musician. He was part of the Stranglers. And he's very good at speaking in public. So
right.
I don't remember exactly what he said, but he was very good. And there were various people who knew that they could handle that kind of, that sort of arena. You know, they could handle standing up in front of 100 people and putting their point across without sort of breaking down and crying, which I knew I would, or something embarrassing. So I remember I didn't say anything because I just knew that I wouldn't be very good at it.
Right.
Even though I suppose I desperately wanted to do a kind of Meryl Streep, I think, you know, everybody, you sort of play a little fantasy of what you want to say, you know, what you might even write down that you wanted to say, and then the delivery, you know, they just don't really marry for me. So we left it to people who we knew who could. So John was really good, and there were a couple of other people, but I don't remember specific little speeches or phrases even.
Yeah.
Apart from weasel words, which was good. No.
Did anyone tell you about the delay tactics that was called, you know, that was all about? Were you clear about that?
About the way that we were trying to delay the process.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we had these people who would come over from, I think they'd fought the archway, something that they'd fought over in Archway. So they were all kind of Islington, Hampstead, seasoned protesters.
Mm.
Very, very middle class, very upper middle class, if anything. Very well spoken, you know, sort of ex-lawyers and upstanding citizens. And they knew exactly how to play everything, so they were kind of like their mentored us.
Right.
And they told, you know, we would go to the pub all the time after, you know, whatever. Well, quite a lot of the time. We'd go to the pub and have our little planning meetings. And so they would, you know, they'd sort of coach us on what the next step would be. And it was just so fascinating. I found the whole process so fascinating.
Mm.
And they'd say, you know, they'd sort of decipher various things that would be going on
right.
in the so-called, you know, public inquiry, which is really like a courtroom.
Mm.
So they'd decipher it all for us, and we're just massive learning curve, really.
Mm.
I think that's what I found so, why I kind of genuinely liked it so much. It was like, it was really interesting, and it was, and you just met most wonderful people.
Mm.
So that combination was quite heady, really, you know, it was quite a heady mix. Yeah.
Do you remember how long it lasted? The...
I don't, you know, I said a couple of weeks, but I don't know. I'm sure someone else would tell you that more accurately.
Mm.
Did Pete remember how long it was?
He didn't talk so much about that, no.
No, he wasn't that involved, to be honest. I don't think he was around that much in the inquiry. Yeah. Seemed to go on for a really long time. It seemed to be there forever, you know, but I think it was probably only a few weeks.
Mm. And did you go quite frequently?
Yeah, I think I did, actually. I think I went between sort of half and every day, you know, between
really?
Every other day and every day, probably.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember you saying sort of we, and it would be interesting to know who you went with?
Yeah, I used to go with Elaine, who's John Ellis's partner, who still is John Ellis's partner, Elaine McIntyre. And so we developed quite a strong friendship, and we still have a strong friendship. And then there would be people that we would just see down there who were, you know, who would go quite a lot. It became quite addictive, actually. I think that's what I'm realising now is, and I'd certainly realised it at the time, it was quite addictive.
Mm.
Sometimes it was quite exciting in that sort of courtroom drama thing, you know, that sort of, you know, arguments being played out that actually did affect people's lives. And because they were talking about our houses, you know, and our lives, effectively. So, and I know, yeah, I remember, you know, because there were very old people who lived on the route of the M11. So we were very much a community, and we were arguing for these other people. And some of these old people would come down, and they were quite, you know, they were not in the best of health. You know, and so we were very concerned about the three or four older people that we knew about who were going to lose their homes, and they'd lived there all their lives.
Mm.
You know, so that kind of thing was quite intense, I suppose.
Mm. Do you remember any of the other artists that went along? You mentioned John Ellis.
Steve Rushton used to come down quite a lot. He was a painter up on Philibert Road. Sheila Whittaker, who was also a painter. Paul would come a lot. John Ellis, who's a musician. There was lots of people who came along. Ian Bourne, filmmaker, who I think you've met, and John Smith, a little bit. more, but I can't remember them off the top of my head. Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's interesting.
What?
Just listening, just hearing about it. It's interesting. It was quite interested. You said you had those demonstrations that you cobbled together. In what demonstrations were?
I think they were quite sort of little dramas, really. They were little things that we played out. And that was all new. I'd never done any kind of protesting before at all. I found it quite scary, quite sort of... I think I'm, as much as I don't particularly want to be, I think I'm quite sort of middle class, fairly straight in some ways, even though, you know, that's not really how I see myself. But so to go and do these things in public were quite difficult, actually. We would, you know, we'd stopped a rush hour flow of traffic on a zebra, and we just did a nice little circular walk, so the traffic couldn't. And I remember thinking, as soon as we'd done it for about 20 seconds, I'm like, okay, is that enough then? Because we were there for like more like 20 minutes, you know, until the police came, I think. I was quite sort of shy, you know, quite shy to do this performing. It was more like a performance, really. And having done a bit of performance later on, you know, in my art, then it was like that. It really was like a performance, and we were all in it together, so that's good. You weren't there on your own.
Yeah.
But there was a scientist guy who was involved, who helped us anyway, The Department of Transport were offering the community a piece of land that was contaminated in exchange for a bit of the, you know, a bit of the road, the planned road route.
Mm.
And we found out that this bit of land was quite seriously contaminated.
Right.
So there's nothing you could do with it. Yeah. And in fact, I don't think you should even walk on it. I don't know what was under the surface, but it was quite an ex-industrial bit of land. So so this scientist guy who was helping us came dressed up in the full kit, you know, the big mask and the suit that you would wear,
the
protective white
yeah.
suit. It looked really good, you know, it looked really serious. And he dug up a bit of the land and put it in a dustbin. So he brought some of this soil, and he was offering it as a kind of gift to the major, I think, and the Department of Transport. So that was good. So we had a protest outside the public inquiry, which was bang in the middle of Stratford and quite a good spot, certainly, you know, lots of shoppers, and brought quite a lot of attention. And I think we got press. I think we had somebody who was very good at getting the press. So
right.
we would get the TV down and
yeah.
and local newspapers. So, And we did... we rolled a piece of carpet which had a motorway painted on it. You know, because we were mainly... Well, there's a lot of artists anyway. We did things that, you know, I mean, not to say anyone else wouldn't paint on a carpet, but it seemed appropriate. A lot of painters got the paint out. And so we painted on this carpet and rolled it out in front of his house. Oh, because you remembered, you spoke to somebody and they rolled something down the front of the... It was John McGregor, the Department of Transport guy. You remembered, or Alison remembers, somebody dropping it down over the front of his house, but I remember rolling it up to his door. So when he came out, and then knocking on his door, and probably running away like little kids on bonfire night. Yeah, that was nice. More will probably come back to me, but I do remember those few.
And did you document any of those? Or at least did someone
I didn't,
something?
But I'm sure somebody did, yeah.
Right.
There's probably a great big file somewhere. There was a guy who lived next door to us called Colin Bex, and he was completely and utterly absorbed in the whole thing.
Mm.
I'd say he was... I think he was, you know, bordering on obsessive about the whole campaign.
Mm.
Took it on board very closely, very personally, you know.
Mm.
I think he was a seasoned campaigner. I think he'd fought quite a few road campaigns.
Right.
An environmentalist, yeah. I haven't seen him.
Mm. Do you remember where that exchange land was that you were talking about?
Yeah, well, there were two bits of exchange land, and one of them was down, well, I think it was the one that was up in Wanstead Park, at the very end of Wanstead Park.
Right.
I think that was what we were offered. And I don't know what I don't know what they were taking in exchange for that. Yeah, I think I was just probably got borne along by more sort of the emotive elements than the specifics. I think that's quite kind of typical of me in a way, that, you know, I'd get outraged, but maybe didn't quite know the whole background to it. So that's kind of what I remember, the outrage. I remember the outrage more than the which bit of land it was. But certainly, you know, this guy coming down with a bin full of contaminated soil was a good way of sort of delivering a point, you know. Yeah. So that really does stay in your mind then.
Yeah.
Very clever. So much better than a piece of paper, although not for a legal team.
Mm.
Not so good for a legal team, but certainly would have brought people's attention to it.
Yeah.
More than, you know, people would not know what was going on inside that town hall, but they certainly would recognise a, you know, a guy in a big white suit with a mask on.
Yeah.
A respirator even, and a bin full of something that said toxic on it, you know. That's a really fantastic way of delivering a point, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you remember how those came about? Were they sort of just...
We cooked them up. We cooked those ideas up in the pub, probably. Right. Or we did have meetings that were outside of pubs as well. But, so we did occasionally have dry meetings.
You don't have to.
So we did. I think we'd probably meet like once a week or once a fortnight, you know, before the public inquiry.
Right.
And, you know, because the campaign went on for a long time, so we'd cook various little schemes up.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd learn what was successful in previous campaigns.
Right.
Yeah. We just have loads of ideas, quite creative, you see. Comes in useful.
Do you remember any of your other small, you know, performance pieces at all?
No, not off the top of my head, no. No. I think it would be good to have this kind of conversation with a few people. I think you'd get quite a lot more out of it.
Mm.
Because people would start to remember and then it would grow.
Yeah. And I was just, you know, thinking about all those events that you're talking about. And did the protests affect you in any way? Did the protests and the events, how did they affect you?
I did used to get upset about what was going on. It did feel extremely unfair, you know, and I think it was dawning on me that we had no chance of winning, you know, the road campaign. Obviously, we still wanted to do it because part of the whole thing was the battle and not just lying down, you know, and saying, yeah, knock our houses down, knock our community down. So, it's not great to lose your positive attitude to life, which I think it was, you know, I think it was whittled away quite a lot over those few years.
Yeah.
So yeah, it did used to affect me actually. I did used to get quite upset about some of the stuff that seemed to be happening.
Did you, as the protests sort of moved on and came closer, did you get involved at all in any other way with the events that were happening locally?
I didn't get involved in any of the stuff that happened on Claremont Road.
Right.
Seemed to let go of it really when the professional protesters moved in. That I seemed to let go of it all then. It seemed to get out of our hands, or certainly I felt like it was out of my hands.
Yeah.
And probably I'd had enough. So it seemed okay that they kind of took it over, really. Yeah. I've forgotten the question. What was the question?
Just really, you know, did you become involved in an event as they move further down towards this area?
No. No, I don't think so.
And when they were a bit further away in places like Wanstead, you were doing the things...
Just on occasion, I'd go up there on occasion, yeah. No, I think it was probably around the beginning, leading up to the public inquiry, and possibly not much after that, that I felt like I wanted to be involved. I think that's, you know, I never kept any kind of diary, so I don't know when I really was involved with it all, but that would make sense that it was before and during, and possibly a little bit after.
And do you feel that you talked a bit about how that influence had an influence on your work in some way, just being engaged with that? Do you want to talk a bit more about, would it be possible to talk a bit more about your work at that period and how those two things sort of came together?
I felt like apart from, I think my emphasis at that time was more to do with a kind of environmental emphasis. Obviously, I was losing my house, and that had, I think that had more of an impact later on. But at the time, you know, going for these walks every morning, picking up bits of nature, using them in the content as well as the form of the work, seemed really very, you know, I don't know what that word is, sort of homogenised. It seemed very right that it was working like that. So it was more to do with the road taking away bits of the landscape, which was taking away bits of the forest, knocking down trees and people's houses. So it was kind of, yeah, using the... using the landscape, really. Plus, I'd grown up on a farm, and I think this was quite important. I'd grown up on a farm, and I was in London, which is obviously such a massive, great big city. Even though, yeah, I'd lived in Hull and I'd lived in Manchester, this was a whole different ballgame. Yeah. Living in London is very different. So there was a kind of sort of looking back on my own life. Right. I think that was part of it as well. So I think, you know, when I think about, I was painting big skies and bits of trees, you know, sort of fragmented bits of trees, as a way of kind of representing the loss that was about to happen.
Did it change from painting to sculpture, or something which was no longer sort of on the canvas?
No, for quite a long time it stayed on the canvas. Right. Yeah, I was sticking things on and on paper as well, and using glue, using a glue gun, which later on my work complete just was only using a glue gun. So. This was when I sort of got introduced to the glue gun. So I was using it to stick things onto the canvas.
Yeah.
So no, I didn't really progress into sculpture for another couple of years, I think. It was still, you know, thinking that 2D was good. Just wanted to use real things. And I did like the sort of combination of painting something real and actually using something real. Yeah, no, I don't remember making anything 3D for quite a while, really. I was doing a lot of painting tracks, sort of. Obviously, there was a kind of road, you know, the lines marking out a road. So this sort of depiction of a motorway or road, but sort of. I remember there was a kind of noting the difference between a track that you might see on an OS map being a sort of bendy, small, dotted line. And then this, and then painting great big motorways through the middle of paintings, which were very straight, you know. So that sort of, I don't know whether that's relevant, but there was some way of, I was definitely kept coming back to this idea of journeys, I suppose. Journeys of people, journeys of cars. Yeah. And this sort of tense kind of skies, which had, like I said, I'd been doing in Manchester. Although I started to paint them in much more of a real way. I started to use realism a lot more. That was what had happened. I dropped abstraction quite seriously and started to really get into painting things in as real as I could. Yeah, I suppose that's a kind of way of trying to be faithful to something. I was thinking that it's more objective, isn't it? It's sort of losing that the emotive quality that my paintings had in Manchester, and using this in a more, you know, a more sort of real, a depiction of something very real that was happening, as opposed to something that was happening in your head.
Yeah.
As possible that was going on without me particularly putting it into words.
I suppose that was a little bit of what I was trying to get at, and the idea of private and public becoming that sort of point where they meet, becoming more part of the work, not just the work about being private and then displaying it, but that idea of what's happening outside starting to merge more.
Yes, except for I don't know if anybody would read that if they looked at the paintings.
Right.
You know, they'd see very real skies in a lot of the work then. They'd see lots of twigs or leaves or branches or parts of trees. And they'd see that kind of, well, for example, painting twigs that had budding, that were just starting to grow their leaves, as a kind of symbolising new life, stroke death, you know, because of the way the motorway seemed to be so destructive, there was an element in the paintings of either, I suppose, I was depicting life, as in real living things, or just tiny little starting to grow things, and eggs seem to painting eggs seem to happen quite a lot. But I do think whenever you make your ideas, when you give form to your ideas, you're creating something public. Even if you, it's very rare that artists paint something and never show it to anyone. I do know artists who do that. I actually find it really difficult to show their work to anyone. And I don't understand that, because I think once you've given a form to something, its natural progression is to go into somewhere where people can look at it. Unless it's some sort of art therapy, which I've never got into, never done that.
Right. That's interesting, though. thinking about the Amy Levin and your work, do you think that's had maybe some sort of legacy within your work? Do you think you maybe not so consciously and all the time, but do you Do you feel like sometimes it comes back into your work? Or you...
I think it possibly does, actually, yeah. I think, I mean, it's hard to know whether you're reading things into something in retrospect.
Yeah.
Certainly the work that I'm doing for the last couple of years, really, has been involved with creating architectural structures
right. That
I am totally in control of, which is, of course, really interesting when you think that I was living in an architectural structure that I had no control over and, in fact, got demolished.
Mm.
And with it, a whole community. So I think that's possibly had a defining factor. Although I'm talking about, 15 years later.
Mm.
So I don't know, you know, whether... It's very hard to say whether it's a real connection or not.
Mm.
I think my work became more political afterwards, I would say.
Right.
Because I think my work was more involved with personal or sort of... I think the work did become more political, yeah. And that's a legacy, certainly. You know, my sort of eyes becoming wide open during that campaign, I think, informed the way I made work afterwards.
Right.
You know, the kind of way that I dealt with ideas. So I think there's maybe two things there. You know, just, you know, noticing work that I did afterwards, which all of this work over the next kind of 10 years was very political, I think. You know, I've got quite overtly, you know, I've got pieces that involve Margaret Thatcher.
All right.
And the House of Parliament. You know, so I was kind of pulling out very specific political themes, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that shortly after, or was that quite or did it span a number of...
Shortly, actually. The dates on the slides. Within the next 5 years, you see. This is, you know, I remember, you know, making this sort of work and feeling, not angry, I think angry is a bit too strong a point, but slightly angry about, you know, our lack of control over our lives, really. But I think that's something that's always been in my work, just thinking about the work that I did back in Hull. I think that idea of control and taking control, I think that was in there then. But came out. I think the campaign probably did pull that out into the sort of centre and made it a bit more explicit.
Right.
My work became definitely more explicit after that whole episode of living in that situation.
Mm.
Definitely. I was quite pleased with the way it went. I think perhaps, you know, I feel a sort of a kind of liberation after, you know, leaving this sort of subjective use of materials and this slightly more removed way of making work.
Yeah.
You know, so your ideas were slightly more removed, not so clear. And I really quite enjoyed this whole time of making things that were quite in your face, really.
Yeah.
For me, quite in your face. Yeah.
And did you produce anything which was specific to the protest at all? other than the, you talk about, you know, your demonstrations, you say you cobble together.
You mean in my work?
Yeah.
Well, it seemed quite specific that I was painting motorways.
Right.
But that would be as far as it got. And they weren't, you know, I didn't paint realistic motorways, so they were.
Yeah.
They were in my own way.
Mm.
But nothing more than that. I remember, you know, John made a little house out of wood. I'm sure other people did.
John
Petinitzo lived
right,
in the house.
Yeah. Did he show it anywhere?
Or? No, I don't think so.
Right.
I've got a little painting of a house, just a simple kind of like a doll's house outline. Well, less than that even. Triangular roof, square.
Mm.
And he gave me that. Not particularly right at that time, actually, a while later, but I think that was a reference to our shared kind of lives.
Mm. And is there anyone else you can think that made work which was, you know, engaged with a protest or specific to artists, I mean, or musicians even?
Yeah, John Ellis made, formed a band called the Roadbreakers.
Right.
And we used to have gigs to fundraise. So they would write some pieces that were specific to the campaign, some road breaking songs. Yeah. Yeah. So he made work. Paul made his plaque piece, which was a good use of, you know, the creative process, I think.
Mm.
I can't think of anyone off the top of my head apart from that.
Mm.
Sure, there's loads.
Where did the Roadbreakers perform? Can you remember?
Yeah, they performed at the Labour Club in Leighton.
Right.
Grange Park Road.
Did you manage to raise?
Yeah. Oh, raise. I was going to say I went. Yeah, I think they did.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they were well received, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, really. Yeah, they were good because at one point he had the singer of the Stranglers, the guy who took over from Hugh Cornwall. He's called Paul. He's got blonde hair. I don't think he sings for them anymore, but he came. The new singer of the Stranglers, he came and performed for one of the gigs.
Right.
So.
And they were busy, I take it, those events.
Yeah. Yeah, they're really good. Yeah.
And they still live nearby, you're saying?
Yeah. John and Elaine do, yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. He would be a really good person to talk to because he's got a very good memory. Very good memory. And was very vocal.
Right.
And, you know, I made work about it, so.
Mm. Just, I was also thinking about the relationship between the artists and the protesters, which would be different for everyone at different times.
Mm. But the artists were often the protesters, they were.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that's. Don't know if there's anything to say about that really, because, you know, some of the protesters were artists and some weren't, and yeah, certainly we brought some creativity into it, into the whole thing.
Mm.
I don't know if it was a particularly special kind of campaign, or, you know, whether we dealt with things in a very different way.
Mm.
Slightly anarchistic, but not incredibly, you know. But certainly the people that we met who were, you know, the people I talked about who were very seasoned protesters, they did approach it in a different way.
Mm.
I think there was a lot of learning on both sides, you know.
Right.
Because we were kind of a bit rougher around the edges, you know. Yeah, I don't know what else to say about that, really.
So, were there many conversations between the seasoned protesters and the artists?
Yeah. They would come to our meetings. We would invite them to our meetings, and we would learn, you know, what they had done in the past and what worked and what didn't work, how to go about the next step, and sort of interpreting things that were happening for us. Yeah. Really, really good people, I would say. Really good people. So that's nice. Met a few of them at the film show.
Oh, right.
A few months ago that you organised. So that was really great. Just the level of commitment that some people give to things is pretty astounding. That's so good to kind of see that. You know, some people who... nobody got paid for any of it.
Mm.
And to have people, you know, taking over small chunks of or large chunks of their lives to try and help us win that fight was really amazing, really. So for all the kind of cynicism that I... built up, there was also probably an equal portion of complete faith in people's generosity and
that's good
kindness, so, and knowledge as well, you know, being so so knowledgeable about all these things.
But also, I was sort of, because of the stuff that was happening when it all came down into Leytonstone, that the main sort of seasoned protesters work, just sort of thinking about things that happened there, where did you see art fitting in with that?
Do you mean when they moved to Clement Road?
Yeah.
Well, it sort of took off in a different direction to what I wanted to be involved with.
Right.
Maybe I'd had enough. But I also didn't, in a funny sort of style thing, I just didn't find that I could relate to that kind of visual protest.
Mm.
Which is really bad. I feel really bad about that, because why would you have to like the way something looks? You know, it's a political protest, and they found the form of expression. It just didn't sit that easily with me.
Mm.
So, all the, you know, the sort of very, very overt kind of, you know, painting of the houses and all of that. I think we distanced ourselves from that, really. I think I did anyway, because I wouldn't have done that myself. I wouldn't have painted a house like, you know, it just, I felt uncomfortable with it.
Mm.
You know, I just didn't make that kind of work. I think, it's funny, isn't it? I feel like I took on board the road in my work, but it didn't change the form of my work, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So I kind of integrated it, whereas, I don't know, the way that they visualised so successfully as well. The way the Claremont Road, the Dongas tribe or whatever you want to call them, the way they visualised it was so kind of, it was so clear and so overt and so amazing, really.
Mm.
It just wasn't what I wanted to be involved with at that stage then.
Yeah.
You know. I think I was happy with the way things had been before then. You know, this sort of more, slightly more academic, slightly more, much more polite, you know, discursive kind of protest, you know, getting really annoyed and feeling like I really wanted to do something, but certainly not willing to turn over the whole of my life to it, be taken over. And you know, weirdly, a lot of it does come down to a kind of a style thing, you know, a lifestyle and a visual art style. It's very connected.
Mm.
You know, the way that we operated was very different to that. So I just slightly, yeah, moved away from it, really. Mm. I was going to say turn my back on it, but I didn't turn my back on it. I just stopped being involved, really. I didn't go down Claremont Road and have a look at things.
Right.
I saw, you know, I would see the occasional thing on the telly and stuff, but I did go down once or twice, that's a lie. I did go down once or twice. I think I sold a van to somebody on that road. Somebody who was in between the part of the protest that we were involved with at the beginning and the way it became, there was a couple who bridged the gap, really.
Yeah.
And I sold a van to Paul. Yeah.
Paul.
Another Paul. Don't know his surname. Yeah.
But you continued to know what was happening, you just...
Yes, yeah, yeah, through word of mouth. Just didn't physically, well, I wasn't physically involved with it.
Yeah.
After that.
Yeah.
I think it was all a bit too much, actually. A bit too much. It was, you know, it became much more angry and it became much sadder.
Right.
So I think I could only handle so much. I think I was probably looking after myself.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing. Because people did get burnt out by it. The guy that we lived with had a nervous breakdown. Doug. Because he just got consumed by the whole way that the public inquiry went and the railroading. And he had a nervous breakdown. In the house. So that was probably a defining factor, actually.
Mm.
And then probably after that was when it became accelerated into a, you know, a professional protest.
Yeah.
The structure, obviously, became much, much different. So, yeah. Left at a good time, I think. Although kind of sad to see it carry on and you weren't involved with it and, you know, perhaps feeling a bit guilty about not going and helping out and, you know.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Do you know anyone, any of the artists, if they did stay involved or...?
I think John and Elaine carried on being involved, but not in a very not such a serious way. No, not really. I don't.
Mm. And so, what was your sense about the effects of the protests on the main streets around here?
During?
Yeah.
I when I was involved in the sort of, you know, the more beginning stages, a mixed reaction, really. Some people just didn't care. Mm. Some people didn't know about it. You know, they literally lived in the area and sort of vaguely heard something, but, you know, being that their houses weren't being knocked down, so they weren't on the corridor, they wouldn't, their lives probably wouldn't, they didn't think they were going to be affected. Some people really wanted it because they saw the houses and they'd been blighted for so long.
Right.
That they wanted them out, you know, they wanted us out and they wanted the houses to go and have this wonderful motorway, you know. And then a lot of people very supportive, so a complete mixture, just such a mixture. And whenever we did little local protests, you know, it would be very good for that, meeting people and talking about it. When the rest of the crew got involved, I don't know, really. I think quite eye-opening, you know, quite sort of mind-boggling, really, the way that they, you know, the way they operated.
Yeah.
It's quite mind-blowing. You know, certainly from the tube, you know, if you go on the tube up to Leytonstone from Leyton, you'd face-to-face with Claremont Road and, you know, massive restructuring of houses and tunnel building and people hanging out on rooftops all the time, you know. Big slogans painted everywhere and cars, wrecked cars and, you know, bonfires, and you couldn't avoid it.
Right.
But you certainly could avoid it if you went down on the road, because it was literally like a little tucked away street. So, kind of odd, that, really. Sort of hidden but very in your face as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any recollections at all about the, also about the way the protest infringed on the streets in terms of demonstrations and that sort of?
No, I think, you know, towards the very end, when the Claremont Road protesters were getting evicted, I think that was when it spilled out. But I don't remember it spilling out before then.
What happened when it spilled out at that time?
I just, you know, I remember hearing that that morning the police were coming down in massive numbers. And John and Elaine actually lived on Claremont Road, so... or Colville Road. Both roads were affected there. Anyway, so I do remember there was lots of people around, there was lots of police around, there was lots of protesters, you know, because the road kind of went like that, and this is the main, Grove Green Road is the main road.
Yeah.
So there were, you know, spilling out these edges, these sort of armpit areas, you know. Banging drums and I think it had got to that point where I just couldn't quite do it anymore. I think it had got really quite painful.
Right.
You know, with Doug having his nervous breakdown and, you know, losing the sort of public inquiry. I think it had just got to that point where I think I'd really had enough. And anyway, at that point, I was in Cattle Road. I think our house had been boarded up.
Right.
And I was in Cattle Road. And that wasn't a very nice place to live, so... I think just generally, it wasn't, you know... Sort of probably... I probably avoided things.
Right.
You know, went the other way. You know, down Leytonstone High Road instead of Grove Green Road. So wherever I wanted to be.
And, did you? I mean, you talked a little bit about the art that the protesters produced, and is that sort of your main memory of what they produced?
Yeah, and they had big sort of parties and.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah, sitting on rooftops is what I remember. which look quite good, really. Quite good. Hanging on chimneys.
Did you see any of the flyers and leaflets and so on that they...
For what?
For the different meetings and events. And...
No, I don't remember.
Oh.
No, that's weird. Don't remember.
Mm. And did you visit the art house on Claremont Road?
No. I never went there. I was, you know, not really connecting anymore.
Mm.
So that's all I can imagine now, looking back on it.
Mm.
Because no, I didn't go there. So I must have just removed myself, really.
Mm. Maybe we should go back to where you were living and your house and so on at that period of time. Talked a bit about your work and the protest. And right at the beginning, we were talking about what your house looked like and talked a bit about the garden and the interior and so on. And I was also wondering, we touched on areas, I think, about changes that you might have made to
yeah.
the garden.
But, yeah.
And I was also thinking about repairs, when repairs needed doing.
Yeah.
And how did that happen and who performed repairs? And
that seemed like a really difficult thing to get in motion. I think because we were paying such a low rent, I think this sort of weirdly felt like we couldn't ask for repairs to be done. Plus the sort of DIY attitude that most artists do have.
Yeah.
That you do, you'll do something yourself, botch it up yourself, but you'll cobble something together and you'll make do.
Yeah.
It's really like that. It's so in a sense, I suppose, you know, if you push that idea, you could say that the house was kind of like a really big piece of sculpture, you know. That, but then we would have looked after it, wouldn't we? And we'd, I mean, I'm not saying we let ginormous things go. We didn't. We would do a certain amount. But we're pretty slow at contacting Acme about things, you know. But nothing huge happened, though. We didn't have major big leaks or anything like that. It was quite a sound house, actually.
Mm.
It was quite a good house. You know, maybe some damp downstairs, I vaguely remember, but that was Tina and Doug until towards the end when we took over there. Their big living room, we had their big living room, but I think generally it was quite sound.
Mm. Did it have a basement cellar. Or a cellar?
Yeah, it did have a cellar, yeah.
Right.
But it was fine, it wasn't big, we couldn't really do anything in it, but yeah, it's quite a lot of room, really. I think there's quite a lot of room.
And did you utilise the garden quite a bit too, or did you?
Not really to make work in, because my work wasn't. I mean, now I can imagine I would use a garden like that. You know, I would build some kind of structure at the end of it. That would be like a studio come workshop.
Mm.
You know, for all the stuff that you couldn't really do in the house, but because it was big enough for that. No, I think John might have made a few pieces of work outside because he moved much more quickly into sculpture. And I think we had a plaque. But no, we don't think we really used it. We just used it for, you know, recreation, parties. Good party. We had very good parties at Philibert Road.
Did you?
And people still remember them. They still remember that house that had all the parties. We did. We were always having parties.
What was the social scene like?
It was really good. We knew a lot of people in Leytonstone. You know, mainly in the pub, because, you know, in the pre-child days, that was what you did. You spent a lot of time in the pub. And, you know, and we would have partisan people come over from all over London, you know, friends from all over London,
right.
because London's like that. You have, you know, people all over. So, yeah, it was good. It was very good. Good socially, you know, good time to be in that kind of community, you know, pre-having kids. And would have been great after having kids as well, because there's a lot of people around that you know and can help you out. But I didn't, you know, I'd moved away before I had kids.
Who else can you remember then living, sort of, in the artists living in the area?
All the people that I mentioned. There was also an artist called Lottie, who lived up the road. She lives in Wanstead now. She's still got an Acme house.
All right.
With her two kids. Oh, it's so hard to remember. Yeah, Pete Owen and Sheila, Matthew Hale. I suppose that, oh, and then people who weren't artists. I had some friends who weren't artists. Living in shared housing, which was part of the road, the proposed road. So, yeah. Artists and non-artists, yeah. Mixture. Yeah.
How many artists were there around at that point?
I really don't know. Acme would be able to give you a figure, wouldn't they? I don't know.
Right.
Lots. I mean, really, I'd say, you know, thinking about Philibert Road, I'd say probably half the street was artists' housing.
Right. Did you know anyone, any artists that lived in houses leased from other housing associations?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I think it was London and Quadrant was
right.
The other one. Yeah. And then private landlords as well. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Pete, who's my partner now, was in a shared house that was a privately rented.
Was that on the
route
as well?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think that was either Claremont or Colville.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And I was sort of quite interested talking about that, you know, social side of it, and you're talking about having great parties and so on. It's also a strange sort of term, but that almost felt like an open door policy.
Yeah.
That existed.
Yeah.
I don't know if you'd be able to explain a bit more about how, about that period of time.
I think people, I don't know whether it is because at that time nobody had children, that there was a no, because that wouldn't really work, would it? You'd maybe knock on people's doors more if you had children. Yes, you did see people a lot. You know, you could just go. I mean, if you were out shopping, you'd see lots of people that you knew. Mm. You know, if you went to the pub, you probably wouldn't even need to phone people up, you know, it was that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know about an open door. I don't know whether we were in each other's pockets all the time or anything. Mm. I don't think that's true, actually. Because I had my studio there, so that was, you know, wherever I have a studio, you only go to someone's studio if you really need to see them.
Mm.
You don't go and just pop in. Because I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't answer the door, probably. I probably would just, you know, carry on working if... Anyway, so I don't know about an open door policy.
Mm.
But it was certainly very friendly and people were around and you did see people, yeah. And, you know, after the pub, people would be going back to other people's houses and... quite It's quite sociable. Mm. Yeah. Lots of drinking. Like we all did, I think, at that time.
Hmm. And I was thinking about the idea of people coming and going. I was thinking about the Whitechapel Open, which was sort of on at that period of time before it stopped for a period.
Yeah.
Did you ever have anything to do with that at all?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I remember you had to sort of sign up for that.
All right.
To get the bus. We had a bus. We had a load of people come round.
Was that for the Open Studios?
Yeah, because the Whitechapel would organise a bus to come round different studios, and they did a Leytonstone bus. So I had half a busload of people traipsing through up into my studio, yeah. Which was great. I thought that was really great. You know, I didn't find it intrusive. I don't think I did. I've always been quite up for showing my work. So to have a busload of people come in and, you know, just sort of say a few nice things and then leave. And go up the road. You know, you could see them going up the road. Quite a good trip, I would imagine. Quite a good trip to do. Very different to the ones where you would go to Carpenter's Road, or you would go to, you know, all those different Acme blocks.
Right.
And you'd, you know, more industrial, knocking on the door, sort of, well, open door, but quite different to go into people's houses.
Mm.
I don't know whether they thought that was great or not, but it was fine. It was fine for me.
Did lots of artists take part in those, do you know?
I think they did. I think they had a good, you know, they had a good number to make it worthwhile. Yeah. Yeah.
Did anyone ever buy anything? Did anything ever come of those studio visits?
I'm not sure. I think they quite possibly did, yes, but I didn't.
Right.
Never had much luck with selling my work.
But also, were there also sort of more casual open studios between the artists that were here?
No, I don't think so, because I wasn't part of a Leytonstone artist group,
right.
Which I think there was a Leytonstone artist group.
Mm.
I don't think I was ever part of anything that was more local. I just remember the Whitechapel involvement. Maybe I'm not sure, to be honest, Anna. I can't really remember. Maybe I did do more than the Whitechapel. Yeah. I think I did, actually. I think maybe I did it once. I don't even know how long I had that studio for before I moved down to Pixie Street. But I do remember having a sort of, more like my own friends around and people that I knew. Treating it like a little show, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. Did you ever apply for the main exhibitions at, you know, Whitechapel Open, rather than just the studios?
Yeah. Yeah, I have applied a couple of times for that and didn't get in. Yeah. I don't know whether it was at that time or not, actually, but...
Right.
Yeah, seemed quite hard to get into.
So that period, how were you surviving? How were you sort of earning?
I was on the dole.
Right.
I was on income support. Quite how I managed that, I don't know. But it was something, yeah, it was definitely what people tried, what artists tried to do, because it meant you could make your own work. Part-time jobs. Don't remember. I remember all my jobs when I was in Stepney. But weirdly, I don't remember any part-time jobs when I was up in Leytonstone. Because I don't remember travelling anywhere to go and do You know, I've done all sorts of cleaning and all that stuff. But I really don't remember it when I was up there. So maybe I didn't do any work, any jobs. God. Enterprise allowance scheme, I seem to remember.
Right.
So you could be a self-employed artist then, which was great. And set up a little business. Yes, set up a little business. Mine was selling jewellery. So I made jewellery out of beads and sold them on the Greenwich Market.
Huh?
Maybe that was that's my job. Sunday morning.
Did you make much money?
No.
Did they last very long?
What, the bits of jewellery? They were good. I saw someone the other day who still had hers.
Really?
Yeah.
That's good.
A couple of great big necklaces. It was before people started wearing great big beady necklaces, yeah. And I made these huge creations.
Right.
Which were quite nice. Yeah.
What about other people that you were living with at the time? Can you remember? I don't know.
John had a job in a framers, mm-hmm. Paintworks.
Right.
The framers bit of paintworks. Paul, I think, same as me, probably signing on. Doug and Tina had jobs. they had proper jobs. I think Doug was a technician. Oh, John was a technician, that's right. John was a technician before he was... Because he'd been my technician in Hull, so I think he got a... He was a technician at North East London Poly, as it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so was Doug. Right. So was Doug. And Tina... I can't remember... She was teaching. She took a teaching qualification and was a teacher.
Right.
Mm. So,
yeah.
Quite a mixture, really, of, you know. It was quite noticeable how Paul and I did more of our own work than anyone else, which we now know why, because we were signing on. No regrets. You take what you can get. Yeah, that was good though, that was really good.
Was it helpful to have people who worked at North East London Poly?
I think John still, technically, John would still give some advice, because I always saw technicians as underpaid tutors, really.
Mm.
And John was definitely like that. And so was Doug, really. So, yes, they were helpful.
Did they ever get the opportunity to use the facilities?
No. Too far away. Right. It was in Plaster.
Mm.
Too far away to go and do anything. I did show in the gallery at where John and Doug worked there.
Right.
So I did sort of, you know, get a little show there, which was great. Just a small space.
When was that?
Don't know. If I had my CV, it would be on my CV. I think, although it's going back such a long time, I might have chopped that part of my CV off. It was about 90,
1990 and 1993. I was, it was interesting thinking about, you know, where you showed, because there was Art East Gallery.
Yeah.
Do you remember much about that?
No, I don't. I think that might have been before we moved up to Leytonstone.
Right.
When we were squatting in Bow.
Right.
And probably a bit before we moved to London, they probably set that up because I know Gary Doherty was involved and he was a year above me in Hull.
Right.
So he would have probably come down here and maybe pretty soon after that set Art East up with other people.
Mm.
So that would mean that there was a good 3 years, really, you know, where Gary would have been in Leytonstone and I would have not come to Leytonstone yet.
Right.
So I think that's when Art East was, because I never went to it.
Okay, so I never went to it. Show there?
No.
Right.
No.
But you knew you were in London at that period, just before you came down?
Well, I don't remember it at all, really.
Mm.
So I think it could have been when that, certainly for the year when I was in Manchester,
mm.
plus a little bit when we were squatting down in Bower, maybe.
Yeah.
Do you know the years that Art East was set up?
it was around in 86.
Well, I was still... I didn't move down here until 87, so...
Mm. Mm.
Yeah.
And one of the things which is interesting is that, well, I think it's interesting, is that City Racing came along as well. Although in a different part of London, it feels like its origins are partly from that Leytonstone group of artists.
Yeah, well, I mean, Paul, Matthew and Pete. So 3/5 of City Racing. The other 2/5 were very much the Oval, you know,
yeah.
They lived together in the Oval where the gallery was. So, I mean, yeah, I think the gallery was started because that it was possible to do something in that house.
Right.
If it had been possible for someone to, I mean, you know, it meant somebody giving up 2 or 3 of their rooms, which I don't think anyone, I wasn't prepared to do that then.
Mm.
So, if there had been that possibility, it probably would have set up in Leytonstone. I don't know. It was a bit more central. It felt a bit more central to have a gallery in the Oval rather than in Leytonstone.
Yeah.
I think we generally thought, who would come up to Leytonstone, you know, to do things like, you know, even when I had my own studio, and I think that's why the Whitechapel organised a bus, you know, it's like, who actually makes the effort to do these things up in Leytonstone and Stratford and... So, yeah, but, yeah. Yeah, the City Racing thing started around that time.
Mm.
And I'm definitely, you know, we got to know Pete Owen and Matthew Hale through the Leytonstone connection, through the campaign, really,
yeah.
I think. I don't think we knew them before then. Because very different colleges, you know.
Mm.
Probably met them via Gary, actually. That's probably
the
point of connection, yeah.
And do you, were you ever involved in any of the conversations about the materialisation of City Racing?
No. Not right at the beginning. I felt quite involved later on when it was set up, but I think they did set it up as a 5-prong little organisation.
Mm.
So,
I
did, you know, physically help with the space, but not as part of the, you know, setting up the running of the gallery.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
So what did you do when you say?
Just
working the space.
Just remember helping, you know, get the spaces sorted out, you know, preparing and painting and. The physical side of setting up a gallery.
Mm.
Yeah.
Did you exhibit
Yeah, I did. I shared there twice. I shared that piece in City Racing.
It's like a sort of tall column.
Yeah.
Oh, let's see.
It's a Big Ben.
Yeah.
It's Big Ben. It's got Canary Wharf moving around on the inside.
Right.
It was my little branch into kinetic sculpture. So that was three people in that show.
Who else was there?
No, hang on. It was more than three. It was nine. And then I showed my jelly tits.
Oh, yeah, what were they?
Ah, okay. They may or may not be in here, actually. I cast 16 pairs of women's breasts in jelly and hung them on the wall at the right height and the right distance apart and...
For that particular person?
Yeah. So it's a kind of homage to the individuality and the sort of beauty of real women as opposed to, you know, the kind of breasts that you see plastered all over billboards that aren't so real. So that, the Jelly Tit show was with three of us showing in that show. That one came afterwards. And then when City Racing did the ICA,
yeah,
they picked the jelly tits to go in the ICA, so
right.
I redid them for the ICA.
And had people change shape?
I didn't recast them, I kept them old, fortunately. That would have been interesting, wouldn't it, to do that? Yeah, so I just redid the jelly and hung them again. So, and I also showed in Bremen in Germany via City Racing. They did a swap, the Gruppe Grün Gallery, Green Group Gallery in Bremen,
mm-hmm.
Swapped and showed at City Racing, the artist's. And me and John, who was at City Racing, and I think Matthew as well. I think maybe it's just the three of us showed in Bremen. So that was good.
Do you remember roughly when that might have been?
Well, yes, because it was around about... There it is. So, I don't need dates anywhere. Let's just get a date off this. 93.
So you were still around in an area?
Yeah. You see, that's only 6 years after I moved, after I finished at Manchester. So in 6 years, my work had gone from being large, quite lyrical, I suppose. Well, not lyrical at that point, but large abstract paintings, oil paintings, to object-based sculpture and installation.
Mm.
And that was quite a conscious effort, really, to keep moving towards sculpture.
Mm.
But you asked me a question, and what did you ask me?
I was just asking when the when you showed in Germany.
93.
What about the other shows? You had a couple of others. Do you remember the dates?
Yeah, this was all around this time. This is when I'd stopped. Having a studio in Philibert Road, I had a studio in Pixley Street. Paul and I both had a studio down there,
right.
Which is a really great place. And we all had a show in this disused industrial space next door, a warehouse space. So we all, about 12 of us, took over that space and put a show on. So that was that one. That was good. What is that? No year on there. That's typical. Oh, 93. Yeah. So all around 93. Quite a good...
Oh, that's only 14.
Yeah. That we moved... My studio was down in Pixley Street, yeah. Which is... Yeah.
I didn't know it was only 14.
Is it still there, Pixley Street?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Very near to the prefabs, where I'd, you know, started off my London kind of life. These studios.
Mm.
So there was that one. There was the City Rising, and there was something in something that Giorgio Sodotti put together.
Oh yeah.
In somewhere that was his studio space. Somewhere, I can't remember where it was. It was like an old squash court and quite a nice big building. So I was involved with that. And then another group of artist studios, which was Mike Landy and that little crowd, I shared a huge piece that was...
Oh, yeah.
You see, that's about dislocation, about being... That was a...
Yeah, it's a sort of a... It's a fort, isn't it?
It's a fort, yeah. So the kind of... backdrop to that, or the context to that piece of work, was the kind of displacement of, well, the kind of racism and displacement of North American Indians. So the sort of using that as a kind of a metaphor almost for possibly the ideas that had come about with the road campaign and being moved out of our house.
Yeah.
I think that was all involved, you know.
Mm.
It was all connected.
Because that's very large.
Yes, it was.
I mean, that's almost house size.
Yeah, it was big. I think it's... details. I'm not very good on measurements.
Oh, no, it's fine.
Yeah, but just to give you a rough idea, it was to the window from here. So the, what is that?
About 18 foot?
Yeah.
Maybe
I think it. I think it was 12 foot. I just seem to remember 12 foot, so something like that. And you could walk into it, and it was made out of cardboard and wood. Yeah.
So in a way, the materials are still quite light in that way as well, aren't they?
Do you think so? Huge sheets of.
They're huge, but the in terms of the things like cardboard, it's.
Yeah.
It still has that sort of...
Yeah, it's not bricks and mortar. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was intentional. Yeah, it's a sort of... Well, it was really taken from kind of cut-out books that kids might learn from,
yeah.
You know. So this sort of pop-up. Pop-up was more of a bit of a theme running through at the time. Mm. Cut-outs and pop-ups. So, yes, you're right, yeah. Light and kind of impermanent... Yeah, there's a sort of impermanence running through here somewhere. Quite flimsy and vulnerable.
Yeah,
you
fragile.
You know, it was fragile, yeah. This sort of, this doll would spin around and flip this suit, so it was all kind of moving and slightly wobbling. Looking like it might, you know, explode at any point, really.
It's
John Major on it.
What's that? Oh, she's got John Major printed on the front of her, on her dress.
On a sort of kinky apron.
Right.
Sort of dominatrix type idea.
So that'd be about 92 then, I guess.
These possibly might not be in the right order because it's come after. There we go. This was the Tufton Street. This was Giorgio Sodotti's show. Yeah, you see, it's got a year on it. That isn't that typical? Cards very often that have years on. But there you go. 93. We're all about 92, 93, I think. I'd really like to know when I moved out of Philibert Road, because I haven't got a date in my head when that happened. Or even how long I was there for, you know? does help having these
yeah
to prompt you and give dates. I mean, yeah, 92 was the big fort.
So with city racing, it seemed to be quite a lot of people that lived in the Leytonstone area, part of the artists, set of artists that lived there, showing initially.
Well, no, not necessarily, no. I don't think it was.
Right.
I think it was more to do with who they knew.
Mm.
So not necessarily people from of that area, you know. It was more like the artist community in general throughout
right.
London. Yeah, but it was very much sort of who they knew and who they wanted to show.
Mm.
And why not? You know, if you're an artist setting up your own gallery and using your own money and all this, you know, there was no sort of, you know, there's no policies set up. It was the work that they wanted to show.
Yeah.
And quite often that would be people that they knew.
Mm.
Or friends of people that they knew. Yeah, I've suddenly found slides of work from Philibert Road, so yeah, roads
oh,
and twigs. Oh, and a house. You see, there is a house in there. You did ask a question at one point about depicting, I think. So there you go. I'd forgotten that I did actually depict a house at one point.
Seems to have streams running through it as well, almost.
Well, possibly. Definitely twigs and road markings. Now, looking back on it, I think I could have taken that a lot further. I had road signs, one way. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting you talking about, you know, living in Leytonstone and showing us some of it connected to people that you knew from here and some of it and other sites and places.
Mm.
You know, it's quite interesting. Were most of those places artist-run or alternative spaces rather than
yeah.
more formal?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, all the ones I've just listed were all set up and run by artist friends.
Mm.
And that seemed to be the way that things were happening.
Mm.
That was quite fresh. I mean, that's quite a recent thing, really, that people would do that.
Mm.
Really healthy, I thought. Yeah.
Did you show in the more formal gallery spaces at all when you were here in Leytonstone?
I did show in... it was more formal. It wasn't particularly well known or anything, but I did show in Greenwich Theatre Gallery,
right,
which is a really nice space and very sort of formally set up. So I did taking the work down that was all this twiggy stuff,
yeah,
and yeah, so that was good. Apart from that. Only the one at... No, because that wasn't really a formal gallery. The one at NELP. I can't remember. I'd have to look at my CV for that. Should have brought it with me. See, there's a very... That's very motorway.
Mm. Very similar to the road piece and with the houses on it. Sort of long and thin.
Yeah.
Sort of almost...
yeah.
The same background coming through. Different colours, but the same sort
yeah.
of... visual
yeah.
effect, isn't it?
And the sort of stormy, impending kind of doom with the black sky.
And what's in the centre of that painting?
Just, let's have a look. It's kind of like a mandala thing, I think. It was painted leaves and then a kind of sun idea, sort of that kind of aboriginal repetitive pattern making thing representing the sun basically. That was the idea behind that. Yeah, So these are all, 89, yeah. $89.90. That's probably the most kind of representative in a way. The sort of, you know, I was talking about the nature idea and involving nature.
Yeah, clouds and twigs and so on there.
Yeah. And then I did this repeated motif of this eyes shut, either dreaming or ignoring kind of eyes shut.
Right.
You know. Hmm. Okay, I'm glad I found those. Makes a bit more sense. Retrospectively.
Mm. Sort of how, at that period of time, how would you sort of describe the London art scene then?
Very healthy, extremely healthy. You know, I think all the artist-led stuff was so refreshing.
Mm.
It seemed like there was a real energy going on.
What was that,
people doing it for themselves was so great, you know. Mm. That you didn't have to rely on, I mean, I think at that time people were still wanting galleries to represent them.
Yeah,
I know I did.
Yeah,
I never succeeded, but, and now it's not important to me, but I think maybe at the time it was. But at the same time, to have all this separate existence of artists being really, you know, together and making things happen was very good. It was very inspirational. I tried to become a City Racing member. It's a long-standing joke that there were only blokes. It's a male club. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But that was the joke. That was the joke at the time. They didn't need anyone else anyway. They were quite happy just, you know, tinkling along on their own. But it was good. It was a very good time, I'd say. Very good time.
And think about East London and what was available there. There's Whitechapel. And what was the sort of... the sense of the London art scene outside of the alternative spaces, and what was out there?
Well, I just remember Maureen Paley, you know, always being around, who Paul became represented by. there was Carsten Schubert. He seemed, because Keith was represented by Carsten.
Right, right.
So we knew... We were involved with that gallery a little bit. And he was very supportive of City Racing, so... You know, even Saatchi, you know, there's a bit of kind of brush that City Racing had, not me by any means, but a little brush with Charles Saatchi, because I think he came down a couple of times and Sarah Lucas started showing at City Racing and then obviously became... recognised by Saatchi. So, yeah. I think we did know quite a few mainstream galleries, some of which are still going, some of which aren't, you know. Yeah, it was good. London, yeah, I think London was, I don't know, it seemed quite a healthy period for artists. I was glad to have been involved with it.
Mm.
Yeah.
So the rest of it you think was sort of Cork Street and so on?
Yeah. Yeah, Cork Street seemed really kind of outside the map, I think, at the time, for me anyway.
But
I think for our crowd,
yeah,
it was, you know, it was not interested, really.
Yeah.
And I think gallerists just started to use the East End.
Right.
You know, Maureen Paley, I think, was one of the first people.
Mm.
I mean, Carsten still had his gallery in the West End, but there was starting to be that split, which right. I always really thought was a great idea, that people would do that. You know, it was very kind of unusual at the time. I think Maureen Paley was quite standing out on quite a limb, really.
Mm.
You know, literally, in sort of this, you know, the East End, which was not at all fashionable then.
Mm.
So, and then obviously people started to follow, and now it's, you would not be in the East End, would you? You wouldn't be down Cork Street. If you were showing that kind of work.
Yeah.
If you were showing really contemporary stuff that was more cutting edge.
Yeah.
And yeah, of course, you know, artists running spaces was because the properties were there to use, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Either at low rent or squatted or just commandeered and negotiated. It was doable.
Mm.
Whereas now, it's not so doable.
Mm. Absolutely.
And maybe grants were different as well, you know? There's some... I know City Racing had a bit of help with grant funding.
Right.
So, that was, you know, that's enough to help you on the track, really.
Mm. So you felt that your relationship living out in East London wasn't sort of hindered by being, as you said, almost out in Essex?
No, I think once you've lived somewhere for a while, you get used to it, and you get used to the distance. The distance becomes shorter,
yeah.
Doesn't it? You know, that just does happen with familiarity. And I just see it as part of the East End, really, now. Just a bit like the furthest part of the East End, you know. I don't see it as Essex anymore.
Do you have any recollection of thinking about the trips that people made out here, the Whitechapel Open and so on, people visiting studios, of gallerists and so on coming out?
No. No, I don't think so. I don't remember. No, because... well, there's only me, really, who had the studio in our house, and... I mean, apart from the guy who put the show on at the Greenwich Theatre Gallery, I mean, he was running that gallery. I didn't have anyone else coming
right.
out.
Right. And did anyone else come? You remember anyone else?
No. I know that Cornelia Parker did live up the road, and so she must have had, you know, people.
Right.
But personally, I don't remember people. No.
Yeah.
I don't see why it would be a hindrance, really, because it's, you know, it's on the tube. There are places far nearer the centre that are not on the tube. You know, Hackney, for example, would be harder to get to than Leytonstone, so...
And I was interested in... You were saying you couldn't quite remember the dates of when you left Philibrook.
No. I think we must have been there for about four years. Oh, it's so hard to tell. I think we were there for about 4 years.
Right. Can you remember the circumstances under which you left?
Oh yeah, we just had to go. We were given a date, and we had to, everything had to be out by then. And it was. We did. You know, we got a van and moved. So. Yeah. Same as anywhere else that you have to move out of. Moved down, actually was offered an Acme flat down in, on a quite a rough housing estate, I'd say, just half a mile down the road.
Oh, what was that?
Yeah, that was on Cattle Road, which doesn't exist anymore, but
yeah.
It was, that was under threat as well. I mean, that was only a short life. Heritage.
Right.
Actually, it wasn't an Acme house. It wasn't an Acme flat. It was just we were referred to them by Acme, which is where we got it. So Paul and I moved half a mile down the road, yeah. Yeah.
Can you remember that point where you had to hand over the keys to Acme? Can you remember sort of how that worked, how this was organised?
I think Roger came and got the keys from us.
Right.
You know, sort of 12 o'clock on a certain day.
Right.
Yeah.
And what was going to happen to your house?
It was immediately boarded up, so no one could squat it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, like instantly. Yeah. And I know we had got people into houses to squat them, but I don't think we did it with ours. I don't think we could do it with ours. I think we tried, you know, different ways of working it, but I think Acme were quite clued up by then, and I think I do remember Roger coming and taking the keys from us. So it couldn't have a future life,
right. You know,
it was boarded up. And then it was knocked down quite soon. Yeah.
So how did you deal with that when you're talking about getting the squatters in to other people's houses as they were leaving? How did that work?
I don't know, because Paul was mainly involved with that. I think you just sort of helped out by like keeping a window open or something, and as keys were handed in at the front door, people came in through the back. I think it was like that. It's really sneaky. Had to be really sneaky and underhand, but legal, you know?
Mm.
And so I think they would... I don't know, because I was never there when it ever happened. Or sometimes I suppose people would leave early and let them in the night before or something.
Right.
And maybe lose a deposit or, you know?
And was it normally done with the knowledge of the people that lived there?
Yeah. 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 I think that was easier to do at the beginning than towards the end, because obviously people learn and they're not going to allow these things to happen.
Mm.
So they'd have security guards probably all over the house at the end. So there's no way of, you know, making that happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of cat and mouse going on.
Sounds like it. And did you have squatters either side of you at all when you were pretty
black? Not on the left-hand side, but on the right-hand side, yeah, it was squatted. I mean, you know, even to the point of all the floorboards were up. So I do remember all the floorboards being up, and they didn't put them down. I don't think they needed that room. So they sort of had the people who squatted it had, and this was only sort of towards the end, because before that it was used as, I think it was fully kind of occupied as a shared house.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, sort of, you know, houses with, you know, all the sort of internal guts of it kind of taken out. Don't even know why now, thinking about it. Or whether maybe the people who took over the house had, you know, the Department of Transport people had trashed it to try and make it unsquattable.
Right.
And then it was reclaimed, and so that was why there were no floorboards.
Mm.
They used to do that, actually. They used to do that. They used to take out floorboards. Oh. Probably sold them and got a good price for them, you know. They were pretty valuable, aren't they? But they would have done that to stop the houses being squatted. But squatters are much more, you know, enterprising, and would find ways of, you know, making the house rehabitable.
Mm.
You wouldn't let anything like that stop them, I don't think. Yeah. Some mad sort of, yeah. I do remember sitting with my legs hanging down through the floorboards, you know, looking sort of downstairs on somebody's house that was half lived in and half, couldn't believe how they were, you know, living in this place with no electrics and no probably no water and...
Right.
I remember cables were always coming into our house for electric and people were coming in for water and baths and... yeah. How are we doing for time?
We're doing very well. I suppose I've got just a few questions and I'm not quite sure how they're going to run.
Mm.
So I'll just go
that doesn't matter, them. Does it?
So I'm sorry about that.
Just go for it, yeah. No, that's fine.
Sort of going back a bit, really.
Mm.
Just wondered if you were ever involved in any other political campaigns or events subsequently.
No. No. Didn't want to be at all.
Right.
Things have come up. I can't remember now, but I remember saying to Elaine, oh, can't do that. We've done that already.
Right.
You know, we've done it.
Yeah.
And it was exhausting and can't do it.
Mm.
Can't get involved. Just remember thinking I don't even feel political anymore, which is not true, but, you know.
Yeah.
No. It was... It was enough to feel like I'd done something that I was kind of proud of, but I'd really had my fill of it.
Yeah.
Had my fill of, you know, feeling like you could do something and then finding out that you absolutely had no chance. Disillusioned is the word.
So paying your poll tax was something that you... Didn't do.
Ah, good point. Yeah, I did eventually. Yeah, I think I sort of held that out as long as possible. But didn't, nowhere near going to prison.
back into the courts.
Hey?
And back into the courts.
No, I don't think I'd let anything go that far. I mean, you know... Sort of even stopped going on protest marches,
right.
Rallies and stuff. Yeah. I know now that I don't really go on them because I just feel like I'd kind of had enough.
Mm.
It's not very good, really, but hey. I've been on one or two, but compared to how I used to be, I'm much, much more non-active.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm. And I suppose what did you think do you think there are benefits of living in a large amongst a large artistic community?
Yeah, I think you do, any feeling a sense of community if you want it is a very good thing.
Mm.
Some people don't want it and they want to live in isolation.
Mm.
But I always enjoyed that, you know. Mm. Being able to talk about your work with people on a daily basis.
Mm.
Was good. Sharing a house was good. On the whole, although not, you know, I think probably did want my own place. Well, Paul and I. But it was good. It was a good place to live in terms of, you know, it wasn't heavily built up.
Yeah.
There's a lot of space in Leytonstone. There still is a lot of space in Leytonstone. You know, Philibert Road particularly had really wide streets, really big houses. Not really big, but, you know, space.
Yeah.
To kind of... feel like you're in London but you weren't being kind of hemmed in.
Yeah.
That was really good. And artists are great people. I think they're great people, you know? Generally. They're sort of thinkers and, you know, thinkers and doers and makers. I like people who do those things, who put ideas into form.
Yeah.
Give form to ideas, not necessarily into practice, but, you know, it's good.
Mm.
They're all very different and unique, individual people, so you know, mix of a mixed crowd that we've always, it's always interesting. And it's always great to be in a community where you know people are actively trying to make their own work, you know,
yeah.
rather than a scary prospect of being in isolation somewhere, being the only artist, you know. And it was a friendly area, you know. People did. It's quite a nice little village feel to Leytonstone,
right?
Which I think still exists.
That's interesting. I was quite interested in the relationship with the local community. A couple of times you've mentioned, you know, people that weren't part of the artistic community, weren't musicians, and people that you felt you were protesting on behalf of as well. And that idea of a small community. Did you have much contact?
Yeah.
Whatever the local community may be.
Well, you know, that's a bit of a strange, you know, it's not, we're not a small village in the middle of the countryside
yeah.
with that complete unity.
Yeah.
You know, it is quite fragmented, obviously. And community, you know, with lots of bits hanging off the edges, I suppose, you know. But yeah, I would... you know, meet and greet all sorts of people on a daily basis, people who live very near, and other people's neighbours, you know, who might be affected by the road, who were affected by the road. So, yeah, and real mixture, you know, really, you know, Dolly, who's really, really old, and Richard's mum, who lived with, who was really old, she's died now.
Richard
Layton.
Right.
And then people who were involved in the campaign who had kids, you know, so families. There was a real mixture. I met such a wide range of people that I probably wouldn't necessarily have normally met not being involved in a local campaign.
Right, yeah.
Well, that's pretty obvious, I suppose, but... yeah, good mixture. Nice to feel that you're part of that, really. It wasn't just artists. It was lots of different kinds of people from all different walks of life, earning lots of different kinds of money and, you know, living in different circumstances. Completely across the board. Very.
Do you think that was sort of general amongst... the artists that they knew, people from the local community outside of their own sort of sphere, I suppose.
I couldn't really say that. I mean, you know, a lot of it was having a connection with the campaign, so getting to know people quite well. I couldn't really answer for anyone who wasn't involved in the campaign, but certainly, yeah, everyone who came to the meetings would. We'd know each other pretty well, you know, because there's always lots of stuff to discuss and argue about, and, you know.
And how do you feel the local community felt about the artists? Big group of artists.
I'm slightly bemused, I think, generally. Slightly unsure, I think, maybe. I can't think of any specific conversations that I had, but... Or maybe that's my projection of it, you know, that's what I'm...
That's fine.
...imagining they might have thought. Yeah, I don't... Not so sure, but possibly... bemused. As most people are about artists, quite bemused.
So I suppose what's quite interesting is that after Philibrook, you're saying you moved out to Cat Hall, but that's still pretty local, isn't it? And then you moved beyond that back to...
Yeah, just had a quick spell in Plaster when I had Ruby, and then we got an Acme flat in Limehouse.
Oh, okay.
So back down to where I'd originally started, literally like two streets away from the prefab, and the squatted council flat.
Mm.
So weirdly, I've only lived in two areas in London in 20 years. I've only lived in Leytonstone and Limehouse.
I think that's interesting.
It is. It's very strange. I mean, it could have been anywhere.
Yeah.
Because Acme could have offered me anywhere in the East End, probably even in South London.
Mm.
And I would have thought about taking it. But it was so fated. Sorry, that's my stomach. I'm starving. It was so, you know, like fate knocking on the door that we were offered an Acme flat in Limehouse.
Yeah.
And a really fantastic one at that, you know. So, with no road. Although lots of building. I seem to live in places until our house now where I'm being built around.
Right.
Which is why I started to make construction cranes in glue. And so, yeah.
But it is interesting that you moved back into the area.
Back to Leytonstone, yeah. Yeah, because of that sense of community. Because I still know people who've always stayed here, who either bought up their Acme houses when they could.
Right.
They were the lucky ones who didn't, they weren't being knocked down, they were just in a blighted area.
Yeah.
So they had the opportunity to buy an exceptionally cheap house, you know, if they could get that together. So, but we didn't have that offer because ours was directly on the route. So, but yeah, a few people carried on living around here, you know, bought properties themselves and the sort of, you know, the ones who always tried to stay in this area still. And lots of people that I know since who've moved up here because I guess they like it. You know, it's quite a good place to be.
Mm. Do you get a different sense of Leytonstone being on the other side of the tracks now?
You mean the road dividing it?
Yeah.
Or do you mean Leighton and Leytonstone? Because that's a different geographical thing.
Yeah, I suppose in the sense that on one hand, you lived very much on one side of the railway tracks and the road before it was built.
Yeah.
But there was another side, which I suppose both the train tracks and the road divided in some way.
I don't think it's as much of a problem as we thought it was going to be, but then how would I really know that? Because I don't live on Philibert Road or on the adjacent roads to Philibert. You know, maybe I would feel like that's carved it up since it was built. But like you said, there was always a railway line anyway. So there was always this idea that you had to go under or over that railway line to get to the main bit of Leytonstone, if we're talking about Philibert. Or, you know, to negotiate that.
And do you think the two sides are quite different? Or quite similar?
Well, yes, in a way. They are different because there's a lot more... I suppose there always has been more people who... Actually, I don't really know that, do I? Because I don't really know anyone on that side. It's like the other side of the road from where we used to live, that that is now, that going upwards from there up to Whips Cross is all that kind of quarter. No, I think the division is more between South Leytonstone, where I live now, because it was cheaper, and top end of Leytonstone.
Right.
Which includes here. and that bit that I'm talking about. And there's certainly, you know, certainly in terms of amenities, shops, whatever, there's more up at the top bit. You know, it's more happening.
Yeah.
It's more going on.
Yeah.
The bit that I live is not so great, really. You know, I think there's probably more community up here, but it depends who you get to know, really, doesn't it?
No, definitely.
So I don't know. I'm not involved in anything that would draw anyone together in a sort of, you know, any... structured organisation type thing, any clubs or anything like that.
And so, still living in the area and obviously with children and so on, how do you feel about the road now?
I don't think about it. It's there. It's good to drive up and down it sometimes. I was vowed I would never drive up and down it. We all said, we're never going to go on that road. But you do. You know, why would you not? I think it's ugly and faintly kind of repulsive. Trying to think of the right word. I think something other than that could have been built. Right. And I think if they'd have done what they did up in the top end, which was cover it over,
mm-hmm.
you know, lid it, whatever they say, it would have been absolutely, you know, fine. Okay, yes, destroying a community. But then they could have built our houses back over the top.
Mm.
And I'm sure if we'd have been well-heeled professionals who could fight it in a different way, like all of us, not just the odd sprinkling, then we could have maybe got that put in place. But we weren't. We were a bunch of artists mainly who had no political clout whatsoever. So, you know, we all got dispersed.
Yeah.
So I think the road is, ugly and bad, but serves a purpose, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's got a lot of traffic queuing up on it every day. It's not very well designed at all because, you know, the argument was always that free-flowing traffic is very clean and static right. or slow-moving traffic is dirty.
Right.
And that road has very slow-moving, static traffic for quite a few hours of the day, you know, both rush hours.
Mm.
That's not good. It's not good. That pollution's got to go somewhere.
Well, I suppose just to... couple of questions just to round it off. One of which, I don't know how you can answer it in a way, but do you think it's... Thinking about sort of the artist group that were here, that large number of artists in one place and the live work studio area, do you think there's a way, do you think it's possible to ever repeat that period of time, how you lived, the way you lived, that group, large numbers of people?
Do you mean for me or do you mean generally?
Just generally.
I think so. I think it is. I think anywhere that's a blighted or a slightly run down area will it will be quite easy for artists or people who like artists who have that kind of lifestyle anyway to move in to kind of use it use it for their own means.
Right.
So yeah, low rent. Sort of flexible kind of spaces, you know, artists can use lots of different kinds of spaces. So I think, you know, but the last thing you want is kind of a very affluent, you know, well-heeled, well-preserved sort of area. Artists don't really tend to populate those kind of areas.
Right.
So I think it is doable. I think that could happen. Probably does happen, you know. I mean, artists are always still coming out of college, aren't they? And they're still up for that kind of, you know, slight... It's a bit like artists do regenerate areas and then they have to leave them because they've done that regeneration, that first stage, or they've kept it ticking over or something. but I don't know. I mean, I don't hear about anything happening like that. Maybe it happens outside of London. Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be interested to know whether that did. You know, whether that kind of urban that sort of populating an area because of the nature of what you do, whether that still would happen with artists. Let me know if you find out.
And I suppose almost lastly, really, what I'm just curious as to what you think what are the primary things you sort of take from that period?
A good sense of community, sort of feeling of belonging to an area, really quite strongly, actually. A sort of sense of my work and my life being integral, integrated, you know, sort of working together quite well. And I think, you know, geographically, not being slightly less pleased with how far out it was. I mean, in those days I used to travel on the tube. I don't travel on the tube anymore.
Right.
So, although I've got used to that and do a lot more cycling. Even then, you know, even sort of hopping on the tube, I think it still felt like it was, I hadn't got used to that kind of distance thing, you know. So it's another 4 miles from where I was in Stepney.
Right.
3 miles, 4 miles. So, yeah. But at the same time as that, always knowing that the one of the big benefits of being in Leytonstone is that you're near all that fantastic open space. So you're so next to the forest. And lovely, you know, the other, it's like having both things. You're able to use London and you're able to use a kind of country, a bit of countryside, slight effect that is. That was always, and still is always, a really good plus, yeah. Yeah.
And do you think the climate's changed now?
Political or
both, really?
Yeah, I do. I think people are a lot less political. I know I am, and I know that could cloud the way I look at things, but I don't think young people know the extent to which, I think politics were much more extreme then. And yeah, everything's slightly central anyway. Always has been in Britain, but I think in the sort of 80s, 90s with Thatcher, you know, it was politics felt like they were quite extreme. You know, like you really had to, you could really notice how things were operating. Whereas now, I think things are a lot more central, you know. Left wing is no longer so left wing, and so I think that's quite a difference.
And in the art, general sort of London art scene or art scene across the country.
Maybe there's a sort of I think it's kind of post artists setting up spaces. I know this is very true of London anyway, that it is we've sort of ridden that wave of artists doing lots of stuff themselves and setting up, running, organising, being, you know, runners rather than waiting. I think we're sort of seem to have sort of got over the bulk of that activity, but lessons, I suppose, you know, people have learned that they can do that, and so there's still a trickle of artist-led stuff. It seems like maybe what happens is possibly artists are doing it to get established more, to get more established as mainstream galleries. I'm thinking of like Vilma Gold, you know, galleries like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then maybe that's just, you know, maybe that's just that I know the City Racing never did want to do that.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm kind of coloured with that experience that they just were not that interested, weren't even that interested in selling work, you know.
Mm.
Whereas I think maybe some of the artists run galleries are. Maybe it's more cutthroat, less chance of getting grants, so they have to, you know, it's more of a case of, do you want to survive, exist? Yes, so we have to be a bit more of this, you know, consolidate a bit more. And apart from that, there's still, you know, there's still great galleries, crap galleries, you know, big galleries, small galleries. London's just, in fact, if anything, it's just, I guess that's happened. It's got the proliferation of galleries is just ridiculous. It's mad, you know, there's way too many galleries. Need some moving up north where I might go. Yeah, so, yeah, a lot. Art is very much more popular now, much more integrated into mainstream society and culture. You know, it's not so... I don't think you'd get such wide eyes if you said you were an artist and people being like, "Oh, what do you do then?" You know, I think, you know, people have seen it a lot on telly. You know, it's been a lot, you know, our culture has subsumed art into it so much more now than when I just left college, though. People are used to seeing artists talking about their work on the telly. They used to, artists making big splashy headlines and justifying it and, you know. It's become much more accepted, I'm sure. A lot of people buy work, want to go see work, take modern, you know, take modern's amazing place for upping the profile of art, contemporary art. Press are a lot more, you know, a lot more studious of coming and checking things out because it's more trendy and, you know, it just sort of goes around, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which is really good, and I really enjoy that, you know. I enjoy that about the scene at the moment, that it's not so sidelined and peripheral. It's more integrated.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.